History of Persia is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia, episode 125 and a half, the rest of last time's AMA. This ended up being so much longer than I expected, which is awesome, but it also means I don't think there's any sense in beating around the bush. So let's start with another question from JV, who wanted to ask for a comparison between Iran and Egypt. As they put it, both are ancient civilizations with history that stretches for centuries and millennia. JV wanted to know why Iran managed to keep its distinct identity and was always able to carve out an independent state with Iranians on top, while Egypt hasn't been so fortunate. As they put it, ever since Alexander conquered Egypt, it has been ruled by a foreign power until it declared its independence in the 19th or 20th century, to the point that their culture is heavily influenced by Arabic culture. What do I think the difference was slash is between the two that made it happen this way? So I have to admit, I don't quite understand how this narrative about Egypt got started. On the Iranian side, I get it. The narrative of independence became very important to Persian and Iranian identity when facing the Ottomans and the colonial European empires. But in reality, these two countries both have very similar histories. I suspect it's because Egypt did not have a ruling dynasty spring up locally for centuries after Alexander, while many parts of Iran did, and because of the linguistic difference. But it's really important to note the asterisk on parts of Iran. Even today, maybe especially today, Iran has many different ethnic groups with different goals and aspirations from one another. In antiquity, this was even more diverse. The process of Persianization, spreading Persian as the dominant language and a medium of greater Iranian culture, really only began under the Sassanids. Up to that point, Persian meant the little chunk of southwestern Iran that is modern Fars. So many of the nominally Iranian dynasties that popped up over the centuries were not Persian. They had a different ethnic and cultural and linguistic background. But over the course of those centuries, many of them Persianized, and that's how we get to modern Iran, where Persian is the dominant and functionally equivalent to the nation-state of Iran. And through all that time, Iran spent a lot of its history ruled by monarchs with foreign origins. Largely Turkic and Mongolian dynasties like the Ghaznavids, Seljuks, the Ilkhanate, the Timurids, and so on. For comparison, Egypt was routinely ruled by dynasties of foreign origin, all the way back to the Hyksos in the Bronze Age, and later Nubians, Libyans, Greeks, Arabs, Turks, Kurds, and a few others. But regardless of whichever ruling family's origin, Egypt was frequently the seat of its own independent state. Even Muhammad Ali Pasha, often hailed as the founder of modern independent Egypt, was in fact born in what is now northern Greece. Both Egypt and much of Iran effectively shook off direct rule by Arab caliphates in the 9th century, only about 200 years after the initial Arab conquest. In Egypt, this was a product of the Tulinids and the Ikhshidids, both stemming from Turkic Mamluk governors who only nominally aligned themselves with the Abbasid caliph. In Iran, it was the Safarids, who had a very similar relationship to the caliphate. Ironically, I think more frequent persecution of Zoroastrians than Christians, and Iran's rapid Islamicization, probably saved the Persian language. It was not as intrinsically tied to non-Islamic religion as Coptic, the final form of the ancient Egyptian language, which became the de facto language of Christianity in Egypt. Deeply Islamic literature was produced in Persian, while Coptic remained predominantly Christian. This culminated in a crackdown under the Fatimid Caliphate, another wholly independent Egyptian kingdom, in the 11th century. Language has a startling impact on culture. It shapes how we engage with one another and with history. It defines what sources and what cultural artifacts you have access to. And linguistic prejudice often precipitates other cultural shifts. The Fatimid Caliphate, in particular, also played an important role in fully Arabizing Egypt. The Fatimid rulers claimed descent from Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad, and through that placed great emphasis on their Arab heritage. They were not an Arab state. They were an Egyptian state, controlling almost exclusively Egypt and its immediate surroundings. But their cultural influence shaped what languages and what attitudes were acceptable in Egypt under their rule. By contrast, while the Persian language hung on, their foreign invaders and rulers were largely Turkic, who didn't have a ton of their own literary culture when they arrived in Iran, and heavily adopted aspects of Persian society for adjusting to settled city palace life. I think that plays more of a role. And we have a question from Joseph. How would life of common folk change throughout this era? Were there substantial changes in diet, in material income, etc.? A similar question on a macro level, were there any changes in the means of production throughout the Achaemenid era? Believe it or not, because I don't talk about it much, this is actually something I try to keep in mind. But generally speaking, the answer is not much. It's worth remembering that change has occurred a lot faster in the last 500 years, thanks in part to technological innovation, focusing on that as a goal, than it did in the preceding 5,000 years. While 250 years back from today covers the entire history of the United States and then some, the 250 years of Achaemenid rule didn't see many widespread innovations for day-to-day life. There were some, though, and some that might have changed material income for the average person, at least in the short term, as the economy adjusted to a new system. Notably, Achaemenid rule and the infrastructure used to enforce it facilitated the spread of currency and a precious metals-based economy across Western Asia. This dramatically altered both how people conducted trade and how they kept track of that trading. It didn't necessarily change the amount of resources available, though. That means that while the medium changed, and that might have benefited some communities in the short term, it didn't necessarily change the overall outline of society in the long run. It just changed the medium that they interacted with. This same system of infrastructure also solidified Aramaic as a lingua franca from Iran to Egypt, and with it, increased the use of papyri and leather as the written medium over choices like clay tablets. This made writing easier to transport and to spread, also demanding a rise in literacy, at the cost of long-term preservation, which wasn't really a concern for people in their day-to-day lives. But keeping better records was. And this rise in literacy and engagement with the written word probably helped facilitate some of the Greek transition and spread of literature during the Hellenistic period as culture changed to both align with their new rulers and to catch up with some of the trends that had been spreading for the last couple of centuries. In terms of the means of production, I cannot think of anything major, comrade. Labor still functioned on many similar systems to the empires that came before, and it would stay that way long after the Achaemenids. Some things, like the actual engineering used to build canals and large buildings, probably spread from Egypt and Mesopotamia to eastern Iran, but they were not new innovations. Technological change was just slow. So we can point to small changes, like a new type of chisel becoming the preferred tool of stonemasons, which is something that is useful to identify archaeological chronology, but the actual system behind who used the chisel and what it was used for didn't change very much at all. Bigger shifts might actually be visible in Greece, where large trade networks and wars, in part due to increased contact with the empires to their east, spurred the formation of large workshops to produce everything from pottery to armor at a greater scale and speed. But similar systems had existed in Egypt and Mesopotamia well before the Persians arrived on the scene. I suspect similar dynamics to what we see in Greece with the solidification of imperial infrastructure and the spread of workshops and systems used to support that also happened in eastern Iran or northwestern India, but we don't have the documentation to back that up. Joseph also asked, how did Achaemenid rulers project power and establish legitimacy? A simple and simultaneously comically overcomplicated question. I like it. Legitimacy is easy. They had the right of conquest, always made sure to emphasize their royal pedigree stretching back further than written records could question it, and from Egypt to Iran and probably well into India, their propaganda always said they had the favor of the local gods. So long as they could actually hold on to power, that alone showed that their claims were true. Now, they projected that power through taxation and redistribution in the form of infrastructure and building projects. Military force backed up their ability to collect taxes, and those taxes were put to use, making Achaemenid rule visible in temples, roadways, monuments, palaces, and in disaster relief. When cities were ruined by war or natural disaster, It was an opportunity to put up new constructs with a dedication telling anyone who could read that it was all done by the governor on the king's behalf. An important part of keeping legitimacy with the king rather than his subordinates was also the policy of centrally appointed satraps and governors, rather than maintaining vassal dynasties. And it was frequently the few satrapies with hereditary governors that became the biggest risk of rebellion. By shuffling around who was in charge when, the king was able to project a sort of soft power in the form of controlling their job and their employment, and reinforce that he was the one ultimately making decisions. Giacomo asked, do we know whether Alexander or any of his entourage acquired some knowledge or fluency of Persian after so many years in Asia? Did his Persian wives and household learn some Greek? I am just curious about how Greeks and the local cultures they met were able to communicate other than through interpreters, and whether there was any actual interest on the part of the Greek ruling class to learn the language of their subjects. This is honestly unclear in the ancient sources. We know that at least some of the Persians in Alexander's entourage did learn Greek, though I haven't found anything specifically about the royal women. Greek sources often suggest that the Persian language they referred to was actually Aramaic, based on the context where it appears, as Aramaic was the language of trade and administration. However, I would personally bet that in all his orientalizing glee, Alexander at least tried to learn Old Persian. That said, it's also worth remembering that there were only about 10 years between Alexander's invasion and his death. The Greek ruling class was still working out what it even meant to be a ruling class, and how to interact with so many different peoples. That said, we can probably take some notes from the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt here, where Cleopatra VII became the first ruler of Egypt in almost 300 years of Macedonian rule to bother learning the local language. Under Alexander's successors, Greek became the new language of administration, and local subjects were expected to get with the program if they wanted to climb the ranks. On a related note, Natin asked, would Alexander and his fellow Macedonians have spoken a form of Greek that would be intelligible to someone from A, Athens, B, Sparta, or C, Thebes? How relatively different was it from other dialects of Greek? I suspect this is being asked because this has been a major debate in classical studies for almost as long as it has been a field. Generally speaking, the ancient Macedonian language is understood as either a fringe dialect of Greek or very closely related to it. Unfortunately, we just don't have much Macedonian in writing to figure it out. And linguists debate where exactly to draw the line between language and dialect anyway, so it probably doesn't make that much of a difference. It was likely something a bit like the relationship between standard modern English and Scots, where they are mutually intelligible in theory and more so in writing, but native speakers might struggle to understand one another. There are instances of Macedonian officers using their own language as a way to speak without other Greeks understanding them. But of the three big cities you listed, it was probably closest to Sparta or Thebes. I would guess Sparta. In Sparta and much of northwestern Greece, they spoke the Doric dialect, which was associated with the myth of the Heraclidae, the descendants of Heracles returning to Greece in the mythical past. Many of the Doric-speaking monarchies claimed descent from Heracles, much like the Macedonians, and it is probable that there is some connection between that claim and their linguistic heritage. That said, Thebes spoke in the Aeolic dialect of Greece, as did Thessaly, which was Macedon's closest Greek neighbor. And these were all a bit different from the Attic dialect, or its cousin-slash-parent group, the Ionic dialect of Greek, that dominated Athens. That said, Alexander and his fellow aristocrats, especially his classmates educated by Aristotle in the Athenian philosophic tradition, knew the Attic dialect very well. And in fact, Alexander and his successors effectively eliminated all of these dialects altogether by promoting koine, literally translated as common, a simplified version of the Attic dialect of Greek, which became the near universal form of the Greek language in the generations after Alexander's death. Also, a genuine historic example of the fantasy or sci-fi trope of everyone speaking the common tongue. Takmaspada asked, could Sagartia have been modern Georgia, as the native name for Georgia is Sakartvelo, given Sagartia's many connections to the land of nearby Media? Since Sagartia is only sometimes included in Achaemenid inscriptions and other times not, could this be evidence for it being somewhere in the hard-to-control parts of the empire on the fringes, hence evidence for Sagartia being Georgian? While an interesting idea, this is what linguists would call a folk etymology. Sagartia only appears as hard-to-control in the context of the Behistun inscription, when everyone was hard to control. And the Sagartians are always portrayed as stereotypically Iranian in Achaemenid art, whereas peoples in the Caucasus and Black Sea region have their own distinct style. Herodotus also portrays the Sagartians as pastoralist horsemen and a tribe of the Persians. Not exactly the lifestyle or identity you would associate with the Central Caucasus, but very well suited to an identification on the Iranian plateau. That also fits with their role in the Behistun inscription, tied closely to the Medes and defeated as part of Darius's Median campaign rather than his attack on Armenia beforehand. It seems to have been a sweep north through Armenia, then east into Media and Sagartia before entering Persia, not a diversion from that larger campaign. The other option, based on the Behistun inscription, is that Sagartia was a smaller region around Arbela, modern Erbil, Iraq, as that is where Darius executed the Sagartian rebel Tritan Tykmes. And it is near an area of the Zagros Mountains where the Assyrians identified a group they called Zikriti, which could plausibly be another transliteration of Sagartian. It's also worth mentioning that we don't have references to the name Sakartvelo for Georgia or the Kartli for its people until the early Middle Ages. We do have plenty of names for people inhabiting that area in antiquity, but the actual name itself doesn't seem to have come into use until fairly recently by comparison. A question from Paul. Does Herodotus or any other Greek historian of the time mention the Elamites as a place or ethnic group? I never recall him bringing them up in his histories. Could the Kissians mentioned in Book 7 be the Elamites, given that he lists the troops of different satrapies in order of importance? Well, classical Greek authors never identify a group that we could clearly call the Elamites the way we can in Mesopotamian and Persian sources. However, they do identify a ton of subgroups in the region of Elam, including the Kissians, which Herodotus places near Susa, and the Uxians, who fought Alexander the Great. They also typically identify Susians, as in the people of Susa, as their own group. However, as we will see soon enough, Hellenistic Greek sources did recognize the Elamites in the form of Elamais, a small vassal kingdom that emerged with some autonomy in the 2nd century BC. Paul also asked, where can I find the surviving fragments of work by Ctesias? Is there a book or website that compiles all his fragments and references to his Persica? There are two compilations that I know of. The one I usually work from for the podcast is Ctesias, History of Persia, Tales of the Orient by Lloyd Llewellyn Jones and James Robson. The other is a PhD dissertation by Andrew Nichols called The Complete Fragments of Ctesias of Cnidus, Translation and Commentary with an Introduction. I will put links to both in the episode description. Another question from Alex, what if everything had been the same on the Macedonian side, but Bagoas's plot had been foiled and Artaxerxes III remained on the throne? How much of a difference do you think it would have made if Alexander faced a more unified Persian Empire with a long-tenured effective monarch? I was actually surprised by how stumped I am with this question, because honestly, I don't know. I think there would have been a more immediate response to Philip's invasion in 336, and if it still happened the same way, which I don't think it would in this scenario, a faster response to Alexander's invasion. But I'm not sure if it would have been fast enough to matter. Artaxerxes III wouldn't have needed to be as cautious as Darius III while trying to balance his own legitimacy. Without the unrest that followed Artaxerxes' actual death, the Persian armies from Mesopotamia and Egypt might also have been marginally stronger. This could have slowed the Macedonian advance, but I'm not sure by how much. I don't think the initial Persian calculus would have changed in how to handle Alexander's initial attack. And nothing would have changed the logistical hurdle of rapidly gathering an army for this new timeline's equivalent to the Battle of Issus. At best, I think Artaxerxes III would probably have had more luck after an equivalent to Gaugamela, either because he would have had more political capital to maintain an effective resistance in Iran, or because he would have prioritized Babylon and forced Alexander into a nearly impossible siege. In that scenario, I think you end up with a new East-West rivalry, a lot like Rome versus Parthia a few centuries early, either with a border on the Euphrates River or along the Zagros Mountains. Alex also had a logistical question. Apparently, some other podcasts offer Patreon-Spotify integration, so that Patreon members can listen to the subscriber version of the podcast feed on Spotify. Do I offer or plan to do this sort of integration? I will be honest, I had no idea that was a thing. That said, the answer is probably not. I'm currently looking at relocating my subscription options away from Patreon in general for a variety of reasons. If that doesn't pan out, I will make sure to get this set up. Either way, if the user interface is your major concern, basically every dedicated podcast app besides Apple Podcasts makes it very easy to connect the custom RSS link you get at the top of your membership tab on Patreon, and I will put Patreon's instructions in the description. We've got two more from Joseph. One, I am embarking on some international travel, and while I will unfortunately not be able to visit Behistun, I will be in Istanbul, Central Anatolia, Tbilisi, and Almaty. Are there any Persian sites you would recommend seeing in that area? Well, obviously, there are plenty of museums worth checking out, most of which will at least have some Persian artifacts in them, especially the Istanbul Archaeological Museum. There's a ton of archaeological sites in Turkey, though most of the notable and publicly accessible ones are on the coast. The biggest site I can think of in that central Anatolian area you'll be traveling in is Gordium of Alexander and the Gordian Knot fame. Unfortunately for the trip to Tbilisi, most of the Achaemenid sites are on the other side of the country. More fortunately, Georgia is not that big, and the Kakheti province also has the benefit of being Georgian wine country. There is a relatively small Achaemenid-era palace complex near Telavi called Gumbati, though I don't know how accessible it is to tourism. There's also a Sassanid complex near Michketa, conveniently just north of Tbilisi. In Almaty, Kazakhstan is a bit too far north for anything ancient Persian, but it is a major area for Scythian archaeology, and Central Asian museums are loaded with Scythian Saka artifacts. Joseph also said that my comment about Alexander considering going north around the Caspian Seas had him wondering, what if Alexander went north instead of south? What if he gets lost in the steppe and/or returns to Macedon depleted? Do the Achaemenids reestablish power in Asia? How does the rest of antiquity play out in this case? Or was the empire probably irreversibly shattered at this point? As a start, by the time Alexander reached the steppe, the Achaemenids were gone. Nobody was putting those pieces back together. That said, I don't think things would have shattered immediately. Alexander's empire was a logistical monstrosity that maintained supply lines and communications across all of West Asia. So he wouldn't have just vanished into the steppe. And if anything, his trip across the northern grasslands would still have taken less time than he spent in India and Gedrosia, assuming he doesn't get wildly sidetracked. By the time they got back to Iran from the Indian campaign, Alexander's army really was depleted, and not much happened. I think the big difference comes with how things shake out if Alexander and his generals wind up in Macedon or Anatolia when Alexander dies, which I do think was inevitable. That would have changed a lot of the power dynamics in the aftermath of his death, and probably would have led to unforeseeable differences in which generals, and by extension, which tactics and styles of rule, ended up in which parts of the empire. That could swing the subsequent wars in all sorts of different directions. So many good questions, guys, but I need a break. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing me with samples. Allergies. There are a few things that make me feel worse more frequently. There are a few times a year when the trees bloom, pollen turns everything yellow, and my sinuses just seem to stop working. I feel miserable. I can't sleep without tossing and turning every few minutes. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. I've been taking Claritin D for my worst allergy symptoms for probably 18 years, and it's an absolute game changer. I can fall asleep and still feel like I am able to breathe. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed. And we are back for more questions, starting with one from Chris. Chris asked, are you familiar with the Reacting to the Past class format? I was not, so I'll provide Chris's summary here. Students are assigned roles, historical and ahistorical characters, and often factions. They must do independent research and then prepare speeches accurate to their assigned role in an attempt to accomplish personal or factional goals. If I got to design such a game and it was set in Achaemenid Persia, what would you choose? Do any historical personalities jump out as great candidates? And what might the factions be and their goals? Chris suggested Darius and his co-conspirators in the Behistun Crisis or the War of the Brothers as an option, and I think those would both be great ideas, though the latter would probably only work for a relatively small seminar since I can only really think of 6 or 7 figures with enough information on them, and even that is kind of stretching it. The thing I struggled with most coming up with an answer here is actually topics that wouldn't require an inordinate amount of research to do, because there are still a lot of topics in Achaemenid studies that would be a great fit, but haven't received enough scholarly attention. Specifically, I'm thinking about the rise of Darius II, where important character details like Sogdiannus's potentially arguing a case for porphyrogeniture are sort of buried in the literature. Other really compelling options, like the Great Satrap's Revolt, are loaded with good ideas for characters, but too heavily debated as to how exactly they happened for me to feel like reacting to the past would be the right way to study them. From what I understand, it's not a format that's designed to really require a dissertation's worth of study. I think something set around 523 BCE, focusing on the period when Cambyses was still consolidating power in Egypt, would be really interesting. Cambyses is an obvious character who would be trying to solidify his rule in Egypt. Bardia, or Gomata, if the student with that role wanted to be cheeky, would be trying to keep a lid on the growing unrest in the empire while his brother was focused on the Nile. The physician advisor Wejahoreznet is in there trying to make the transition to Persian rule easy for his people and to climb the ranks of the new hierarchy. Pharaoh Psamtik III is plotting his glorious return to power as a prisoner in Cambyses' custody. You could even throw in some more speculative characters like Darius, still as one of Cambyses' young bodyguards, and some other co-conspirators who would have been generals. You could also have something related to Patubistet, the would-be pharaoh who revolted in western Egypt as soon as the Persians left. I think that makes our factions for this class Cambyses and the mainstream Persians, Bardia and those unhappy with Cambyses' rule, pro-Persian Egyptians, pro-Psamtik Egyptians, the early stages of Darius's coup, and maybe some idea of another set of rebel Egyptians or Libyans. Of course, there's also a ton of more conventional events dealing with Greece, too. The Ionian Theater of the Peloponnesian War, or the Corinthian War especially, provide a massive roster of well-documented historical characters to game out. I'd love to watch a class session where Tissaphernes somehow manages to come out as a major successful figure instead of the bumbling jerk reputation he earned historically. William asked a few interconnected questions that I'm kind of breaking up to put in the other part of this AMA event, so for now he asked, how has the perception of the Achaemenids shifted over time in historiography? When did Western historians start to assess them as something other than the bad guys from Herodotus? In terms of modern historiography, at least back to when academic histories started being written in the 1800s, this is kind of a tricky question, because in altogether too many cases, we are still trying to get historians of Greece to treat the Achaemenids as more than the bad guys across the sea. Even very early modern histories, drawing entirely from Greek sources and the Bible, presented a transition from the noble and righteous era of Cyrus to a decadent and cruel era under Darius and Xerxes. And you'll see a similar, if somewhat toned-down, version of that these days, too. Whether that's Victor Davis Hanson, Tom Holland, or even Dan Carlin, the narrative of decline has been hard for Achaemenid studies to break out of. That said, we are finally making progress. Even from the first translations of cuneiform inscriptions and tablets or Egyptian demotic in the late 19th century, historians who specifically studied those regions or studied Iran and West Asia realized that they had to confront evidence and soften their original portrayal. That said, 19th and early 20th century authors still had a tendency to use the Greco-Persian Wars as an allegory for European conflict with the Ottoman Empire, even when writing history. A.T. Olmsted's book, The History of the Persian Empire, published in 1948, marks a major turning point in Achaemenid studies as one of the first significant books to really renounce that narrative. Still, it wasn't until a series of conferences called the Achaemenid History Workshops in the 1980s that everyone who primarily studied the Persian Empire got on the same page. And it's only in the last 10 to 20 years that conclusions reached in those workshops became dominant among classicists, Egyptologists, and Bible scholars when discussing the Persians. Tengeni also asked about historiography and added, "Are there any notable historians one should pay attention to? Does the field have its own version of what Edward Gibbon did for Roman history? Are there any Persian figures historians have softened up to or become more harsh towards? And what does the future of the field look like?" In terms of its place in our hearts and likelihood of being the first thing someone dipping their toes into Achaemenid studies finds, A.T. Olmsted's book I mentioned a moment ago is probably the closest thing we have to Edward Gibbon, albeit mercifully much shorter. In terms of age and length, I guess George Rawlinson's The Seven Great Monarchies of the Ancient Eastern World is probably similar to Gibbon for ancient West Asian studies in general, although it covers much more than just the Achaemenids. That all said, in terms of being a massive, foundational text for the field that looms over every interpretation written after its publication, Achaemenid studies is only about 40 years old as its own field, and our Gibbon is Pierre Briand, with his book From Cyrus to Alexander, which is starting to show its age almost 30 years later, but it has yet to be supplanted. On that note, this is my regularly scheduled reminder that The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon is almost 250 years old and is no longer a valuable source for studying Rome. It's interesting as historiography, but so much has changed in scholarship since 1776. Please do not reference Gibbon as your primary source of information on the Roman Empire. Now, the general perspective on the Persian Empire has softened over time, though I'd specifically point out that Xerxes and Darius III have been seriously reconsidered in the last few decades. Traditionally, both were painted as somewhat incompetent villains. These days, both are treated as capable administrators with extraordinarily bad luck out of Greece. Cyrus the Great, on the other hand, is probably the figure who has been revised most harshly, in part as a rebuke of Pahlavi-era Iranian propaganda about the Cyrus Cylinder. The future of Achaemenid studies is, of course, an interesting topic to me. On one hand, few niche humanities disciplines have seen more growth in the last 40 years. On the other, the humanities as a whole are under constant threat, with anything even remotely niche being cut from university after university the world over, as governments and other programs slash funding for the humanities. There are simultaneously more people dedicating their studies to the Achaemenids than there have been in almost a century, and fewer places to teach or employ them. In better news, future research is at a very exciting tipping point. The generation of scholars that participated in the Achaemenid history workshops is reaching retirement, and new ideas are gaining traction. There are even new Achaemenid history workshops being held over the next few years at the University of California, Los Angeles. The biggest shift that's really started to solidify in the time I've been doing this podcast is a major reassessment of the first few generations of Persian rule. The so-called Taspid kings, Cyrus, Cambyses, and Bardia, and the role that Elamite culture had in Persian imperialism. Next, a question from Jan or Jan. I couldn't tell from your surname what your pronunciation would be. Who said, I'm curious about the population numbers in the Middle East at the time of Alexander's conquest, as I have trouble imagining how the Greeks and Macedonians could have dominated such large amounts of territory. How many people were there in Greece? How many soldiers? How does that scale across larger populations like Egypt and Babylon? So, by most estimates, the Achaemenid Empire had a population somewhere between 25 and 40 million people by the time Alexander arrived. For this question, we can probably go with the low-end estimate or even a little less, because that figure includes Greece and the Balkans, some very rough numbers for steppe nomads, and the Indus Valley, where Alexander largely left things to local vassals like King Porus. Alexander crossed the Hellespont with 37,000 soldiers and somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people total, once you account for various servants and camp followers. Over the course of his campaign, Curtius and Arrian make lots of references to reinforcements from Greece and Thrace crossing conquered territory to catch up with the main army. The numbers on that aren't clear, but the rough estimate is something like 100,000 soldiers, presumably with thousands of additional supporters to follow them. Mainland Greece had about 3 million people, but for these purposes, we can probably increase that to around 7 or 8 million to include Anatolian Greeks and Thracians who were part of Alexander's core recruitment pool. On its face, this sounds like a massive hurdle, but a very important detail to keep in mind is that there were only about 1 million Persians, and they had ruled all of this for about 250 years. Unlike earlier empires, the Persians replaced the top local administrators very early on and didn't deal much with vassal kingdoms. And Alexander mimicked that approach by installing Greek and Macedonian governors or Persian defectors who relied entirely on Alex to keep their social status. That meant there wasn't any formal military or political system opposed to Alexander in the conquered territory to organize a potential revolt. And unlike later empires, like Alexander's own successors or Rome, there was not a concerted project of Hellenization under Alexander, If anything, he seemed to try very hard to keep things the way they were. This eliminates one of the major flashpoints in historical occupations of cultures creating friction up against one another when the ruler tries to enforce a different style on the subjects. That is a dynamic we will see cause problems in the next few dozen episodes. On top of that, it is extremely important when discussing ancient history to remember that patriotism and nationalism, pride and loyalty to the existing government, are modern concepts. The vast majority of the Achaemenids' 25 million subjects didn't particularly care if the people in charge were Persian or Macedonian or Greek or aliens, so long as they didn't burn down their houses. The vast majority of people, regardless of time and ideology, don't particularly want to risk their lives on principle. So most people are unlikely to rebel by default. And the people who were had all just been defeated, killed, or exhausted by resisting the invasion in the first place. However, a lot of people will tend to want to ingratiate themselves with the levers of power. So once the Persians were out, all of those people started to cooperate with and even fight alongside the Macedonians. That meant that all Alexander really had to do was keep a few hundred to a few thousand people in the centers of political and economic power, with enough mobility to go squash a peasant revolt in the countryside. That situation didn't really change after Alexander's death. Ironically, the conflict between his successors, the Diadochoi, probably prevented rebellions by drawing on the resources and the conquered population to fight in their new wars. By the time the region saw functional peace again, two generations had already lived their lives under the Hellenistic system. Why would they resist it any more than their ancestors had resisted Xerxes or Artaxerxes I? Eduardo asked, "How do you think Alexander would have governed his empire if he had lived longer? I already get the sense that his homeland of Macedonia and Pella were becoming politically irrelevant to him. He's keeping some satraps on, appointing new satraps, establishing himself in the Achaemenid royal cities. I get the sense that he's governing less like a Macedonian king and more like the King of Kings. Do you get this sense as well?" Funny you should ask, Eduardo. Absolutely. Many, probably most histories of the Achaemenid Empire or Alexander conclude that he was, in many ways, the last Achaemenid king, and I think that is accurate. Alexander was not only very careful not to disrupt the systems of government already in place, but he was working to integrate the Macedonian and West Asian nobility into one imperial system. And he frequently encouraged, if not forced, his companions to join on his own Persianization. Had Alexander lived, I think history would probably view the transition as a dynastic shift from Achaemenid to Agiad and little more, rather than the era-shaping cataclysm we actually got. That said, I also think longevity would have harmed Alexander's reputation for the ages. He was never portrayed as invested in the actual task of governing an empire. It's almost all flashy building projects and plans for conquest. I don't think this would have dissolved the empire or anything, but it probably would have led to some successful rebellions or secessions sooner rather than later. Like I said in the previous question, the wars of the Diadochoi actually prevented more rebellions from popping up by draining soldiers away. I even think it's possible that Alexander or one of his immediate heirs would have lost Greece, Egypt, and even Macedon itself, as it became more and more apparent they had inadvertently found themselves part of a Persianate empire based in Babylon rather than triumphant conquerors. All right, just two more questions to go, and they are the ones that I really wanted to wrap up on. Javander asked, looking back on all the history of the Achaemenid Empire, what advice would you give to a Persian Shah upon ascending the throne? Make sure you are stable, then immediately make sure that everyone knows who your heir is supposed to be. And as soon as you can, give that heir some genuine authority to start ingratiating themselves with the nobility and the provinces before you pass the torch. If at all possible, ascend the throne young enough that you don't have sons until you become king. Alternatively, stop having kids once you ascend the throne. So much of the unrest in Achaemenid history is the direct result of unsteady successions. Shout out to our sponsor, Royal Fratricide. Finally, a question from Nima. Can you put the reason for the Achaemenids falling into one paragraph? On one hand, I can put it into a single word, Alexander. On the other, oh God, how do I compress this down to a few sentences? All right, let's see. In the entire history of the Empire, there was exactly one undisputed succession, right at the start between Cyrus and Cambyses, and even that didn't end well. By the 4th century, the lack of coherent succession laws created opportunities for unrest that drained resources and created windows of opportunity to challenge the central authority of the king, draining resources and compromising security in key border regions like Anatolia. The Achaemenids tried to balance a system of all power resting with the king and regional autonomy, but in doing so, created a system where they were neither prepared for a genuine foreign threat nor capable of responding to one with speed. And with that, the Achaemenids are behind us, the Hellenistic Age is in front of us, and I will see you all next time. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you will find my bibliography, the Achaemenid family tree, and plenty of other things, including the support page, to financially support this project. There are all sorts of ways to do that, but most importantly, there's patreon.com/historyofpersia. You can sign up for a monthly subscription ranging from $1 to $20, and access to things like ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and discounted merchandise. Even if you don't want to subscribe, you can also visit the show's store, either through historyofpersiapodcast.com or historyofpersia.launchcart.com. You can also support this show for free by leaving a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. I always love to see your feedback, but even better than that, tell your friends to listen to the History of Persia. Share it on social media at History of Persia Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and just History of Persia on Twitter, and everything else that's trying to be Twitter. Thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.